scared. That's for sure. Where he's from, folks picked up by the authorities were sometimes never heard from again. Feeling the heat on his neck at the thought of what must have gone through the poor boy's mind, Garrett worked to cool his temper. But Asadi's a tough kid. Did exactly what you told him. Took care of the horses before calling to let me know you'd been locked up. Still don't understand that part. Responsibility. There was unmistakable pride in Butch's voice. That's why he took care of the horses first. Taught him you finished the job no matter what. With a nod, he added, good life lesson.
Good life lesson, Bridger scoffed. How about not getting thrown in jail? How's that for a life lesson to teach a kid?
Butch slammed his fist on the table.
I told you. I was doing a good deed. They were manhandling Kate.
Garrett looked around at the other patrons, who either didn't notice or had become accustomed to Butch's trademark outbursts.
What the hell were they supposed to do?
He leaned forward and lowered his voice.
She had a gun and was threatening to use it.
Butch batted off the notion.
Oh, she's just talk.
No, she's not, Bridger argued. Kate shot at a damn airplane that was flying over her barn just because she said it stirred up her horses.
Yeah, well, it was a cartel plane dropping off drugs. Turns out she was right to do it.
But she didn't know that. Bridger was turning red with exasperation. You said it yourself. She just thought it was an oil company.
Even better, Butch retorted with scorn.
Garrett had to keep himself from laughing. It was nice to see Bridger taking up an argument that usually fell on his shoulders. But his brother had a serious point. He loved Kate and hated to think she was losing it. But she was getting quick to the trigger, a little too quick. And this time, it had come back to bite her. Garrett was about to back up Bridger, not that he needed it, when Kate returned and sat. She scooped the napkin off the table and dropped it in her lap.
Every time I get back, I always wish my food was sitting there waiting for me.
Kate added with an assured nod.
You know, like on Pulp Fiction.
Garrett felt Bridger's elbow beneath the table and knew exactly what his brother was thinking. How could a frontier woman like Kate, who'd never even owned a television, come up with that one? He'd dig on it later, since there were bigger fish to fry. Garrett fumbled for a response, still sidetracked by the Tarantino movie reference.
Yeah, well, the judge is treating this a lot more seriously than you are, says Talon can press charges.
I'm taking it serious, Kate shot back. Fighting these bastards the only way I know how, with a gun.
Bridger interjected.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Annie Oakley. Any fighting you do from here on out needs to be of the legal kind. Talon will let this go if you promise to behave.
He turned to Butch. Same goes for you. But they did get a temporary restraining order. Butch looked more worried than Kate.
What does that mean?
Bridger continued.
A TRO means you're not allowed on the property for a while.
Butch pounded the table again. This time it got the attention of the other patrons.
My own damn ranch?
He immediately settled himself down, not because he cared about who might hear, but because their food arrived. As soon as the waitress left, he continued, albeit slightly more docile with hash brown in hand.
Ain't no piece of paper gonna keep me off my own property.
You bet your ass it will,
Bridger answered, a mouthful of pancakes.
But not forever. This one lasts 2 weeks. But my guess is, if you lay low, the judge will reconsider. You'll have to stay out at my place until then.
What about me?
Kate hadn't touched her eggs, just poked at them with a fork.
What am I supposed to do?
When Bridger didn't reply, Garrett spoke up, not really knowing what to say.
Same goes for you, Kate. Might have to bunk with one of your daughters until this thing blows over. Isn't Beth Ann over in Sunray?
Yeah, but she won't have nothing to do with me these days. Neither of my girls will.
Why not? Bridger asked.
On account of me selling my land to your family.
Ah, hell. Really?
Garrett hadn't done anything wrong, but damned if he hadn't made a good case for her selling the land. And as his dad had said, she wouldn't have sold it to anyone but him. Hoping to assuage his guilt, he offered up a solution.
What do you say, Bridge? Y'all got room for one more?
Garrett felt the elbow in the ribs again. This time it wasn't playful. His brother's awkward silence was followed by a response so fake it wouldn't have fooled anyone in the world but Kate.
Well, of course we do.
He jabbed Garrett's ribs twice more,
with a force that might have inflicted internal bleeding. Cassidy and the twins are down in Corpus Christi for cheerleading camp this week, so we'll be roughing it. Living off venison sausage, borracho beans, and Lone Star beer. Think you can handle it? Garrett scooted his chair out of Bridger's elbow range. His dad looked less thrilled than Bridger at the thought of his new bunkmate, but the old man had made his bed by running over that truck driver with a quarter horse. Actions have consequences, and Butch was reaping the reward of his good deed. Bridger turned the topic back to the case.
In the meantime, I'm working on the legal side of things to see what can be done, or at least see what we can do to make sure this thing is a little less painful. Maybe get Talon's mind moved to somewhere out of the way.
The news brought Garrett a little hope,
but I thought you said you've seen the maps and were right in the middle of what they want.
Bridger nodded as he finished up a bite.
Yeah, not surprisingly, Holloway keeps Talon's research close to the chest. We won't get access to that, but I've got a geologist buddy down in Amarillo working on it now.
Garrett was hoping maybe Talon would get out there, dig around, and come up empty. That happened all the time in the oil business. Geologists get excited looking at seismic data until they drill a dry hole. Of course, rare earth minerals were different. Sounded like there was a lot more certainty in their research. Bridger continued.
Obviously, this isn't my geologist's specialty. He was skeptical of a big find around here, but said it wasn't impossible either. Gave me a science lesson on ash deposits across the plains following some volcanic eruptions in the Rockies over 2 million years ago. Kind of like oil and gas, you don't know if it's really there until you start drilling. And given the demand for rare earth minerals, the whole world is starting to look.
Not the answer Garrett wanted. So he thinks it's legit.
Common sense,
Bridger said with a nod.
Talon Corporation is here to make money. They wouldn't be out here spending a fortune without a damn good reason.
It occurred to Garrett that just like Kate, he hadn't eaten a bite of his own breakfast. Having a greater craving for answers, he pushed back from the table and rose. He wasn't a geologist, but that didn't mean he couldn't do some digging of his own. And there was no better place for it than at the dive bar to end all dive bars. If his buddy Ike Hodges didn't have answers, nobody did. It was time for a trip out to Crippled Crows.
16.
Garrett was surprised to find Crippled Crows vacant of patrons when he walked inside, especially given the fact that there were at least a dozen pickups scattered about the parking lot. Standing in the middle of the concrete dance floor, he turned in a full circle, baffled by the quiet solitude of the normally raucous honky-tonk. The dilapidated dive, constructed mostly of cedar fence posts, corrugated tin, and particle board, was bathed in an eerie blue tint from the fluorescence above the pool tables and neon beer signs on the walls. Wondering if he'd missed the rapture when Ike's cronies had somehow made the good Lord's cut, Garrett had to laugh. His mother always said you'd find Jesus in some strange places, but she'd never been here. At least he sure as hell hoped not. About to leave, Garrett turned suddenly at the sound of boisterous laughter coming from the back. Instead of retreating, Garrett marched across the dance floor to a party room and knocked on the door. When nobody answered, he said a quick prayer for safe passage, twisted the knob, and barged on in. It was hard to tell which odor hit the nose harder, the plume of cigarette smoke or punch of rot-gut whiskey. Either way, it was a full-scale assault. If Ike cared about Garrett interrupting his poker game, he sure didn't show it. His face lit up as he waved him in.
Get our boy a drink, Crystal.
Ike looked unusually haggard, even for a man who wrecked his health at an Olympic level with wild turkey, unfiltered camels, and a never-ending rotation of trailer park hussies. To Garrett, Ike always looked a bit like a coyote, even in the way he ambled with a sort of sideways gait. The rangy barman, who usually kept a week's worth of stubble around his gunfighter handlebar mustache, had worked it up to a full beard. His salt-and-pepper locks, usually short-shorn, had grown over his collar. As he strode over to welcome Garrett, the wild-haired blonde in cutoffs and a red tank top moved with a sexy slink to Ike's makeshift bar, an overturned 50-gallon drum covered with liquor bottles. Crystal didn't take his order, just dispensed into his glass a brown liquid that didn't look fit for disinfecting a flesh wound, let alone human consumption. Ike chuckled.
I'd have offered you a barley soda or the good stuff, but these boys drank us out of house and home a couple of hours ago.
The barman always kept a six-pack of Scheinerbach beer and a bottle of Still Austin bourbon around just for Garrett. But apparently, they'd broken into his hidden stash of reserves. Garrett didn't fuss, just gave the obligatory nod. This'll do the trick. And do it quicker, I reckon. Hit me. Crystal brought the glass over, sloshing it onto the concrete. After handing it over, she stared him down like he was a perp in a lineup.
Hey, I know you.
Garrett shook his head.
Nah, I don't think so.
He wasn't actually sure, but Crystal didn't look like the kind of gal you wanted to hear those words from. Ever. Her face scrunched as she studied him.
Yeah, you're one of them coal boys, ain't you?
Yep, she knew him. But it wasn't until the busty barmaid threw her hand on her hip that it all came flooding back to him. Nurse Knockers. At least that was the nickname Bridger had given her when she'd waited on them several months prior. How could he forget? Crystal was exactly how Dolly Parton would have turned out had she stayed in Pigeon Forge and joined the carnival. Before Garrett could acknowledge his error, she gave him a good scorching.
Yep. You're the one tore this place up and left a big old mess that I had to clean up. Didn't even leave a tip.
Garrett thought back on the incident where Bridger had broken a beer bottle over a guy's head and slammed his face onto the table. It was well-deserved, for sure, and bloody, for certain. But Garrett knew he'd left a tip. Of course, his dad had always told him never argue with a woman scorned, in any way, shape, or form. Taking Butch's counsel for probably the first time ever, Garrett yanked a crumpled $20 bill from his front pocket and handed it over.
For your troubles with interest, ma'am.
He smiled, wide, considering the matter resolved, but apparently it wasn't. Crystal took the money with a scowl, then walked away without a word of thanks. Garrett considered himself lucky that was all she did or didn't do. Having watched the scene play out, Ike just laughed.
Can I deal you in?
Garrett shook his friend's hand and surveyed the players around the table. It was a ragtag assortment of cowboys, truckers, and a gang of outlaw bikers, none of whom you'd ever willingly join in a game of poker. All Ike needed was Clint Eastwood leaning against the bar, and he'd have created his own modern version of Hang 'em High.
Better take a rain check.
Garrett snuck a peek at the crowd around the room, who were waiting their turn. The ones at the table went back to their game, but those against the wall didn't look thrilled to see an interloper.
Looks like you've got a few antsy to double their paychecks.
Ike looked around.
They'll wait if I say wait.
No doubt they would, Ike. Garrett checked his watch. It was just after noon. A bit early to get a game going, isn't it?
Early.
Ike looked thrown for a loop.
We've been going since 2 o'clock this morning, and it's just now getting good.
That explained the dour faces and bloodshot eyes. And maybe it had something to do with the burr under Crystal's saddle. Of course, she'd probably never been a debutante. Garrett suspected that had her boss been absent, she'd have introduced her knee to his crotch.
Well, I hate to interrupt, but I had a few questions, if you got a minute.
Got more time than that for a friend.
Ike turned to Crystal.
Keep an eye on things.
She gave a nod, took a slow lap around the table, and the rowdy players got noticeably quieter. Had she a billy club to whack on her palm, Crystal could have been a Depression-era railroad cop trolling the tracks for a hobo to beat.
Let's step outside.
Ike led Garrett back into the bar and to a nearby table.
I was wondering when you'd show.
Garrett dragged out the metal chair that screeched across the concrete floor. He took a seat, marveling how fast Ike got intel. He referred to Crippled Crows as the Redneck JIOC, a joint intelligence operations center where Texas High Plains gossip was procured, analyzed, and distributed to friends at his own discretion. Garrett hoped like hell Ike had something of value.
Guess you heard the good news about what's going on out at the ranch.
If it was good news, I doubt I'd have heard it. Bad news travels like greased lightning.
Ike chuckled.
Human nature, I guess.
What do you know so far?
About Talon digging a big crater in your backyard or your daddy using one of their drivers as a doormat for his horse?
Both, I guess.
Ike lowered his voice, which was rare, even when dishing out the juiciest intel.
What I know about all that won't be as much use to you as some of the other stuff I've heard, like what's going on behind the scenes that led up to all this.
Leave it to Ike to stoke the embers of suspense like a Wild West Alfred Hitchcock. Garrett looked around and leaned in.
This about who's behind the Talon deal?
Ike gave a single nod.
There's a reason you hadn't heard anything about this until now. And the reason isn't all that surprising. Politicians view money and votes as one and the same. From the county courthouse to the White House, this Talon Corporation deal is a no-brainer.
Must be something wrong with my brain because I don't see it.
You would if it wasn't your place being destroyed.
Garrett shrugged. If you say so.
Well, it's all for the greater good, you see. Ike chuckled. Gotta think like one of them swamp rats in Washington.
The word progress had been thrown in Garrett's face earlier, and now it was greater good. He couldn't help but think back again to his Comanche ancestors, booted off their land for the sake of achieving both. He thought about digging more into the politicians behind it, but what was the point? As Ike said, it was a no-brainer on their end. Upset a few for the sake of many. But what got his curiosity up was Ike's comment about the other stuff.
Okay, Ike. That all tracks with what Bridger told me on how this happened so fast and why it was kept quiet until now. Legislators knew there'd be a stink. What else do you know? Well, I've seen that symbol on the side of those Talon trucks before.
The Firebird? Garrett asked.
Yep. Saw it in Africa a few years ago when I was flying contract for an oil company. Well, a security detail for an oil company.
In places like Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and parts of Latin America, some security details were in fact just private military companies. Garrett had been recruited by a few friends from the special operations community right before he got out of the army. The paycheck was outstanding, but sometimes the work was sketchy, depending on the outfit. No money was worth some of the things you might have to do to earn it. Ike, on the other hand, had a more tolerant conscience. He'd been highly recruited into the contracting world, even more so than Garrett. As a former pilot with the Night Stalkers, technically the Army's 160th Special Operation Air Regiment, Ike was in high demand. He'd flown the AH-6 Little Bird helicopter and had combat experience when nobody else did before 9/11, notably the Battle of Mogadishu, more commonly known as Black Hawk Down. Ike continued.
Saw that same Firebird design. First in Nigeria, then in Angola. First encounter wasn't a problem. Second time, we had a whole lot of trouble.
With Talon?
Not them, I clarified. Whoever the advanced security team was that paved their way.
Who were they?
No idea. Always in the shadows.
Ike's eyebrows raised.
That's why they're so good.
Good at what?
Going toe-to-toe with some high-speed, heavily armed American operators out in the jungle, and making sure they were never seen or heard from again.
17. As Smitty's rust-bucket Chevy rattled down the Caliche Road, he couldn't help but think that working for Talon Corporation out on the Cole Ranch was a bad idea. He'd figured himself rid of Garrett after Mexico, and was content not to see him for a while. Making a fresh start was about cleaving off the past, and that meant everything that was tethering him to it. Driving a bulldozer, of course, was a step in the right direction. Sure, it was a return to his old line of work, but there was nothing wrong with that. He just had to stay clean, mind his business, and work his damn ass off. Smitty could do that, no problem. With the ring of his cell phone, Smitty answered Crystal's call. She was no doubt wanting to wish him luck on his first day. He tapped the speaker button to keep both hands on the wheel. Before Smitty could say hello, Crystal barked out,
"You late?"
He shook his head, even though she couldn't see him. "Nope, right on time." A pause on the other end.
"Got all your gear?"
Smitty knew he did, but rifled through the items beside him for good show.
"Yep, FR coveralls, hard hat, safety glasses, and steel toes on my feet. Got it all, babe."
Another pause on Crystal's end.
"Get your supper?"
"Sitting right by me."
Smitty crumpled the paper sack so she could hear it. It wasn't much of a meal, truth be told. Just deviled ham on a hot dog bun and what crumbs were left over from a bag of stale Funyuns. But at least she tried. She'd done it all when she got home from Crippled Crow's after being out all night. The gesture, for Crystal, was as close as it got to saying, "I love you."
"Okay, then. Guess I'll let you go."
It seemed as if she wanted to say something, but held back.
"Got a double shift tonight, so I'll see you in the morning."
Smitty was working up the courage to tell her something sweet when she ended the call. Part of him was disappointed, but realistically, she'd have only spat out a gruff response, maybe even an insult. He confessed it to the universe instead.
Love you, Crystal.
No sooner had he said the words than he came upon the massive Talon compound, flanked by a half dozen trailer houses acting as offices. With its army of workers buzzing around and massive Caterpillar D-10 bulldozers pushing dirt, it was clear the company meant business. Smitty couldn't help but smile. He needed work, and they had plenty of it. He pulled into a parking spot in front of the mobile office marked with a sign out front that read Talon Corporation Main Office. All visitors sign in here. Then he turned off the truck and went inside. Normally, the first thing to hit you when walking into one of the trailers on a drill site is the stench of a place that should have been junked 50 jobs ago. It's a pungent combo, usually emanating from an endless row of sweaty work boots and a cauldron of coagulated tuna helper on the stove. But not this place. This one was brand spanking new. There were guys who looked just like him sitting in folding metal chairs along the wall. They had the look of newbies, fresh to the job and anxious to get started before someone at the company changed their mind. A big old dude in a black Talon Corporation polo shirt with the badass Firebird logo looked up from his computer.
Yo, Ray Smithy.
The guy had a weird accent. Foreign. Of course, that wasn't unusual in the energy business, particularly on seismic jobs. Over the years, Smitty had worked with at least one person from every hemisphere. Smitty nodded, wondering how in the hell he knew it was him.
That's me.
You're lit, the guy growled.
He picked up a clipboard with a stack of paperwork fastened on and handed it over.
Go sit with the others. This is your crew.
Smitty learned a couple of things in the exchange. The men beside him were his new best friends, and on time meant late. Must be Germans. From here on out, he'd be the first to arrive. Smitty had just sat in one of the metal chairs when he realized they'd supplied no writing utensils. Looking up, he saw the foreigner was no longer at his desk. He called out, "Sir," seemingly to no one around, then looked to his co-workers who didn't offer their own. They were already pissed off that he was late. So as not to hold up the process any further, Smitty rose in search of a pen. Making his way down a narrow hallway to the door at the rear of the office, he broke the threshold to a throng of shouts. Before he knew what the fuss was about, a beefy hand clenched his throat and pinned him to the wall. The giant doing the slamming asked in a voice as foreign as the one he'd just heard up front at the desk,
"What are you doing here?"
Smitty eked out the word pen through constricted vocal cords and raised the clipboard for proof. The brute let go and pointed with the same hand to the door. A sign Smitty had clearly not been able to see with it swung open posted a warning, "No unauthorized personnel." Around the giant, three men gathered stacks of papers, shoved them into a cabinet, and banged it shut. With the catch of a pen, tossed by the silver-haired man who'd hired him, Smitty turned on a heel and sped to his seat, hoping like hell Talon wouldn't hold it against him. 18. Garrett knew that he should have canceled his lunch date with Lacey given everything that was on his mind, but she'd just met with Dr. Travis for the court-ordered kid exchange and would need some cheering up. Losing her children to their dad, even for a weekend, always left her down in the dumps. What took her mind off things was meeting at the Coney Island Cafe, a little hole in the wall in Pampa that had changed little since it opened in 1933. Given their uncomfortable relationship conversation the night before, Garrett didn't want to add fuel to the fire by calling off their date, and quite honestly, he didn't want to miss it either. Coney Island was their special place, and a ritual he'd come to enjoy. The problem was that he couldn't shake his worries over the ranch and what he was going to do to save it. Ike's revelation about the Talon mercenaries didn't intimidate him, but he rested no easier either. And Garrett wondered if the company's ruthless tactics may be carrying over into the legal realm, which might be worse. He could hold his own in a toe-to-toe brawl with gun-wielding thugs, but lawyers with politicians in their back pocket were an unstoppable force. Lacey leaned over and put her hand in front of Garrett's eyes.
You in there somewhere?
She smiled when she said it, but he could tell she was a little annoyed. Garrett cleared his throat, trying to buy a little time to recall what she was saying.
Turks and Caicos, right? Travis wants to take the kids on vacation before school starts.
Lacey looked puzzled.
Yeah, but that's not the issue.
Then what is?
Lacey's hands flew from her sides.
The fact that he wants me to go with him?
How the hell had he missed that part?
Garrett fought to keep calm.
What on earth for?
Same reason I told you. Travis says we're still a family, even if we're not married.
This isn't hiking over at Palo Duro Canyon, Lacey. This is staying together overnight.
Lacey pushed what was left of her pecan pie to the side, having only taken a couple of bites. She'd clearly lost her appetite.
Obviously, we wouldn't stay together. He's offered to pay for a separate room.
Garrett could feel himself losing the fight to keep control.
That's even worse.
How's that worse?
Garrett would never admit it, but the thought of Dr. Travis paying for a lavish vacation for Lacey bothered him almost as much as the thought of her in his bed. He chose not to answer that question lest it reveal his jealousy.
Well, are you going?
Lacey looked hurt by the question. Her voice softened.
Absolutely not. I told him, no.
Of course she did.
Lacey was as solid as oak, loyal as hell. Garrett felt guilty for asking. Before he could apologize, she asked,
What's going on with you? With us?
Those were two separate issues entirely, but both needed to be addressed, badly.
Look, I'm sorry, Lacey. It's just with everything going on with the ranch and the Asadi situation, my plate's kind of full right now.
Her brow furrowed.
Too full for me?
Damn.
It dawned on him how his answer must have sounded. All she wanted to know was where they stood, but he couldn't give her an honest answer, at least not until resolving his other problems.
To hell with the ranch.
He loved the land with everything in him, but it wasn't flesh and blood. Asadi, on the other hand, was. And he wouldn't let that kid go without a fight to the death. Unable to tell her or explain that, he opted for doing what men do best. Deflect.
We've both got complications. You with Travis and me with Asadi.
My ex isn't a complication, Garrett. He's the kid's father, and despite all the horrible things he's done in the past, I have to give him a second chance. For their sake, not his.
No matter how she sold it to him, Garrett couldn't see it as anything other than Travis trying to weasel his way back into her life. And the fact that she was buying into it drove a wedge between them. With deflection a bust, Garrett turned the conversation to the ranch.
Well, first things first, I've got to figure out a way to get Daddy back home. You know how he is about those horses. He'd have left me, Bridger, and Grace to fend for ourselves on Christmas morning if he thought his real family needed him.
Lacey smiled.
That's true. Nothing will ever compare to his horses.
She shook her head.
Except maybe Asadi.
Garrett nodded in agreement.
Yep, he's the exception for sure.
It was the perfect time to reveal he was thinking about making a run for it if they tried to take him away. Lacey would understand, he knew, and she'd do it for her own children without hesitation if circumstances ever came to that. But for some reason, Garrett chickened out. It was still too early to lay that burden on her without knowing anything for sure. That conversation would have to wait.
It's why I'm so worried about the ranch.
Garrett looked deep into her eyes.
This Talon deal has everything in jeopardy. For Dad, Asadi, hell, the ranch saved me. You know that.
Embarrassed to say it, but unable to hold back, Garrett confessed.
So did you.
Garrett knew those weren't the three words she'd been longing to hear. But they were close enough. Lacey loved him as much as he loved her. But he just couldn't say it. Not yet. Not until he could make the long-haul commitment and knew he was staying for good. Lacey's face beamed.
Let's just say we saved each other.
She reached out and took his hand into hers.
I'm in your corner. For better or worse. Your fight is my fight. Whatever's eating you up inside, Garrett, it doesn't have to. You've got a wingman right in front of you.
She paused and added,
if you want one.
Garrett couldn't help but chuckle at the thought of her using the term wingman. No girl but Lacey would have used that one to describe their significant other. But she knew who she was dealing with, a battle-hardened soldier looking for a partner to join him in life's trenches.
That's exactly what I want.
Garrett readily admitted, a smile rising at the thought of it.
And let me in.
Lacey reached over the table and gently tapped him on the left temple.
Into that thick head of yours, so I can help.
Garrett sighed, feeling a weight lifted from his shoulders.
You really want to help?
Lacey's eyes brightened.
I wouldn't offer if I didn't mean it.
Among the many qualities Garrett admired about Lacey, one that stood out above all others was the fact that she was a woman of her word. If there was a fight to be had, she'd be the first on the front lines. Lacey had proven herself more than once, and he hated to press his luck. But with the Asadi situation being what it was, there was a good chance he'd put her to the test. 19. Lacey had almost forgotten why she was driving through Canadian sleepy downtown when she glanced over at the deposit slip and an envelope full of cash from her mother's cafe. She'd been trapped in her head, not fully regretting the earlier conversation with Garrett, but wondering if she'd pushed too hard. The fact that her ex-husband was seeking to reconcile would turn a minor mess into a major morass and likely throw Garrett's trust issues into overdrive. Lacey wanted nothing to do with Travis beyond what related to their children. She loved Garrett with all her heart. But she also knew that a rambler's gotta ramble and wondered if her hard-charging special agent boyfriend was really ready to settle down. She had just gotten her wits about her after parking the car and walking into the Happy State Bank lobby when she lost all semblance of composure. Seeing her old best friend from high school was like seeing a ghost. The younger sister of the newly deceased Preston Kaiser could have been his twin. Vicky had the same blonde hair, sharp patrician features, and slight raise of the chin, which must have been built into the family's DNA. She was in a white silk blouse, Fendi belt around her skinny waist, and handmade suede city boots on her feet. Not a wrinkle, not a frown line, not a glimmer of anything other than moneyed perfection. Vicky had either been living a carefree life or had a little help from Dr. Botox. Either way, she looked just like she did in high school. Everything about her telegraphed class and style, the way Lacey had been before her family lost their fortune. She only hoped the wafting scent of Vicky's Creed white amber masked the stench of her own clothes, reeking in crisp bacon and well-done hash browns from her mother's cafe. Vicky's hand flew to her chest. Oh my God. Lacey Mansfield. Is that really you, girl? Suddenly, Lacey was all too conscious of her own outfit, the uniform she wore on the breakfast shift, white V-neck t-shirt, faded Levi's, and New Balance running shoes. She was tempted to make up a lie, but getting caught would be worse than caught in the couture. Vicky. Lacey was brought into her old friend's embrace before she could get out another word. When Vicky let loose, she struggled to come up with something, anything to minimize the awkward fact that her dead brother was involved with the cartel that had tried to kill her. Fortunately, Lacey didn't have to begin.
Actually, I go by Victoria now. Victoria?
Vicky wasn't exactly cutting it in the business world. Changed it when I got my MBA. Lacey tried not to sound as impressed, but failed.
You went to business school?
Wharton, right after Vanderbilt. Oh, you know, Daddy, everything's got to be the best. Lacey didn't know anything about Wharton, only that it was one of the top programs in the country. Having dropped out of TCU when her father died, Lacey never finished getting her degree, even though she'd promised herself she would. Between lack of education and no way to upgrade her first name like her old friend had done, she was left feeling deflated and vulnerable. Fighting off the panic from her insecurities, Lacey regrouped and turned the attention on Victoria, which was how her old best friend always liked it.
So, what brings you home?
After Preston's situation, the government pretty much came after every asset we had in Mescalero Exploration. Fortunately, our family's other companies were insulated, so I resigned from a venture capital firm in New York to come back and pick up where my brother left off.
I was brought on as a partner by Talon to head up their mineral acquisitions.
Lease and purchase lands for the company. Talon thought the Kaiser name might settle concerns about a group of outsiders moving in and taking over. Lacey wrestled back a grin. With Victoria in charge of acquisitions, it was possible she could keep Talon from destroying Garrett's ranch. But before she could raise the issue, Victoria moved on. So how's Travis these days? Lacey went from deflated to demolished.
Well, speaking of name changes, I'm back to Capshaw.
She'd made the change immediately after the divorce, wanting nothing more to do with him beyond their shared custody of the children. She didn't want his prestigious name or the money. She'd not accepted a dime.
Travis and I split up. A couple of years ago, actually. Lacey, I am so sorry.
I had no idea.
No, it's fine, Victoria. I mean, it's not exactly the kind of thing you advertise.
No,
of course not. Still, I'm sorry to hear it. It's okay. We make it work with the kids. That's the main thing.
Lacey couldn't help but think that Victoria looked at her a little differently. Travis was from an affluent family from the prestigious Wolfland neighborhood in Amarillo. Lacey had once owned an art gallery there, where she displayed her work and ran in those elite circles. Now she was just a hometown girl, with nothing but the prospect of an entry-level job with Talon. Victoria seemed to brighten.
You dating anyone? Because I know a few single guys who would be... Oh, no, thank you. I guess that's the good news. I am dating someone and very happy.
Victoria looked genuinely intrigued. Anyone I know?
Yeah, you remember Garrett Cole.
Victoria's face screwed together. Bridger's little brother? Despite the fact that she, Victoria, and Garrett were all in the same grade, she remembered Bridger first. Of course, he had always been popular and athletic, a real shining star in high school. Bridger was the dashing rodeo champ and quarterback, and their sister Grace was the homecoming queen. Garrett was the forgotten kid brother, who was either hunting or on horseback when everyone else was at the big party. Lacey wanted to tell her that the scrawny kid she remembered was now muscled and handsome, the DEA badass that helped put her scumbag brother and his cronies 6 feet under. But she couldn't say that. For the sake of everyone, that story had been swept under the rug.
Yep, Garrett's back in Canadian working with his dad. You remember Butch, right?
It was obvious by Victoria's deer in the headlights look that the awkward reality had set in. Her company was destroying his ranch.
Oh, yes. I met him years ago through Grace and Bridger.
She glanced down at her Cartier watch and eyed the door.
Look, I'm late for a meeting, but I'd love to catch up sometime. Can we have lunch soon?
Before Lacey could answer, Victoria waggled her cell phone.
Oh, I'm getting pinged right now. Gotta run.
She leaned in, gave Lacey another big hug, before moving out the door. Lacey stood there in the bank lobby in silence, having forgotten again why she was there in the first place. It dawned on her in the moment that Victoria had not given her a card or told her how she could be reached. She wasn't sure of it, but her old friend's mention of lunch was possibly an invitation, something people say to minimize the awkwardness. There'd been plenty of that after the divorce. It was sometimes easier just to pretend nothing was wrong. And the reality was that Lacey no longer belonged in Victoria's inner sanctum. But what bothered Lacey had nothing to do with society and everything to do with helping Garrett. Victoria may not have anything more to say, but Lacey certainly did. If there was a chance that she could leverage her friendship to save the Cole Ranch, she was going to take it, even if it meant losing what little pride she had left. 20. Garrett had just driven past Kate's ranch headquarters when he saw the dozers, graders, and dragline excavators belching black exhaust as they bit and tore into the earth behind his home. With the crust peeled back, the pounding sun zapped what moisture remained, leaving a hovering mirage on the horizon as far as the eye could see. What was once fertile acreage for grazing and growing his alfalfa hay was nothing but a wasteland of exposed soil. They say that before you die, your life flashes before your eyes. But Garrett had lived his life with one foot in the grave and never had that experience. Watching his land be destroyed, however, in the dusty wake of the yellow machines, brought the passing of time to a painful crawl. He relived every long walk, Sunday picnic, and trail ride across those once bountiful plains. Recounting all the arrowheads he'd ever discovered, Garrett couldn't help but dwell on the ones still hidden, the ones Asadi would never find. They were scooped into iron buckets, dumped into semi-trailers, and hauled off to God only knows where. Garrett prided himself as a man who never went off half-cocked, but the surge of bile could not be capped. Whoever had crushed the grove of trees where his mother was buried was in for the ass-kicking of a lifetime. Jamming his boot on the gas, Garrett gritted his teeth and jerked the wheel right, careening off the Caliche Road across the pasture. Laser-focused on the mammoth Caterpillar D-10 bulldozer desecrating the Cole family plot, he brought his GMC to up over 50, nearly bouncing to the ceiling with every dip, dive, and chug hole. Within 50 yards, Garrett was flanked by two white pickups, no doubt Talon security guards who'd been watching his approach. Mashing the accelerator to the floor, Garrett left them in his dust and arrived just in time to reach the dozer, which was heading for his mother's headstone. He swerved into its path and jammed on the brakes, skidding to a halt within feet of the grave. Garrett jumped out,
Fortunately, with the wherewithal to yank the Nighthawk from his belt and toss it in the passenger seat, lest he lose what little self-control he had left and do something he'd regret. With the passing seconds, Garrett worked to cool his temper and put the matter in perspective. He sprinted forward, grabbed the handrail to the dozer's cab, and pulled himself up onto the first step. His back foot had just lifted when Garrett felt the tug that ripped him from the railing and slammed him to the ground. Garrett scrambled to his feet and turned in a circle to find two beefy guards in tan tactical pants and black polos with the Talon logo. They owned him collectively by a good 50 pounds. Both men had shaved heads and powerlifter physiques. The only distinction between the two was the one on the right sported a close-shorn Fu Manchu mustache, but both wore a smug look, the one that says, "I dare you." Not one to disappoint, Garrett unleashed a left hook on the guy that grabbed him, followed by a right fist to Fu Manchu's solar plexus. Both hits landed with force but were easily absorbed, like punching a side of beef. Garrett shuffled right to get from in between them and the dozer as the one massaging his jaw pivoted and tried to follow. He rushed Garrett on wobbly legs, but the clumsy blitz was easily dodged. As the guard's weight carried him forward, he tripped on a dirt furrow that sent him headfirst into the tilled soil. Fu wasn't as reckless, nor as off-kilter. He'd swapped his "I dare you" for an "I'm glad you did," throwing out his arms before raising his fists. There's a look guys have who really know how to fight, and this guy wore it like Conor McGregor. It's not just technique, it was his swagger. It was more than evident by his ease that this dude was a real scrapper. As Fu advanced, Garrett raised his fists but was a bit too sluggish to block the first jab. Fortunately, he dipped enough to make it only a glancing blow. A little dazed, Garrett backed to regroup as a fury of punches came flying in. He ducked one, blocked another, but took a solid left to the cheek that sent him backpedaling, off balance, and landing on his butt. Fu's partner moved in from behind, but Garrett scrabbled to his feet and spun out of grasp, keeping a keen eye on the boxer, who kept a steady advance. With words of Joe Bob Dawson, always close to the heart, Garrett remembered his favorite philosophy on fisticuff fairness. He said, "To the guy who's getting his ass kicked, there's no such thing as a fair fight." With two against one turning out poorly, Garrett remembered his only weapon, the Twisted X steel toes. Fu had just launched another onslaught when Garrett let loose a low kick to his attacker's leg, landing the steel tip of his boot on the kneecap. Mountain or not, the big man crumbled into a heap and grabbed his leg as he moaned in pain. Garrett had just turned in search of the other when tackled from behind, landing in the dirt with his attacker beside him. Grappling in a plume of dust, he came out on top, cocked a fist, and smashed the guard's nose. Only feet away from his mother's sullied grave, the crunch of bone and cartilage beneath his knuckles felt good, and it felt justified. Raising his fist for another blow, Garrett felt his arm catch, body lifted in a state of weightlessness as he was dragged backward and dropped to the ground about 10 feet away. Spinning out of reach, he looked for Fu, but found Holloway instead. The Talon landman was flanked by another guard, who was as big and pissed off looking as his friends. Garrett was about to rise when a guard unholstered his pistol and aimed it at him. Hurt and enraged, but smart enough to know when to stop, Garrett raised his hands, conceding it was time for a ceasefire. "All right, Holloway. I know my limits." Holloway smiled, seemingly amused, and offered Garrett his hand.
"Something tells me you don't."
Although winded from the tussle, Garrett turned down the help and struggled to his feet on his own. He dusted himself off, fighting to lower his temper before launching into Holloway. The standing bodyguard stepped toward Garrett, but their boss waved them off.
"No need for that."
Holloway looked Garrett in the eye.
"Right, Mr. Cole?"
"So long as you get that dozer away from my mother's grave. Otherwise, you'd better call up every man you got."
Holloway turned to the grove of trees and studied the small headstone at the base of one of the cottonwoods. He turned back, looking a bit contrite.
"I didn't know that was there."
"Well, you would have if you'd asked. I thought we were in the negotiation process."
"We were in the process." The female voice that interrupted Holloway seemed to come out of nowhere. "Time to move on."
Garrett had been so blind with rage that he hadn't even noticed Vicky Kaiser in Holloway's passenger seat. Marching up,
She wore that same smug look he remembered from high school. She'd been the quintessential mean girl snob who'd lived to make everyone's life a living hell. Before Garrick could reply, Vicky continued. Surface damage payments were agreed upon years ago by our grandfathers. Market rate. Bridger should have told you already.
And what about what you did here?
Garrett pointed at the bulldozed trees and his mother's desecrated gravesite. What's the market rate for this? Vicky swallowed hard.
That wasn't.
Bridger didn't tell me anything about this happening today, because I'm guessing he didn't know. Have to think that was intentional on your part.
Vicky shook off the suggestion. Only thing intentional here is maximizing profit. Every second this equipment sits idle, we're losing money.
Well, at least you're honest about it, Vicky. I'll give you that.
You're no fool. Vicky stared him down. A hothead, maybe, like your father, but you've figured this thing out, haven't you? Garrett wasn't sure what Vicky was driving at, but assumed the whole nicey-nice friend of the community garbage that Talon had been selling was all a crock. Kaisers cared about one thing and one thing only. Always had.
So it is about the money.
Vicky didn't miss a beat. When isn't it?
Garrett pointed to his mother's grave. When it's about that.
Holloway, who'd been quiet for some time, broke into the conversation.
Look, fair enough, Mr. Cole. We hear and understand your concerns, and this clearly wasn't our intent. But this is an active mining site. I can't have you making trouble for us out here.
Garrett gave a nod.
Then at least let me point out some of the places that are off limits.
Holloway studied the gravesite a moment before turning back to Garrett.
We'll fence this place off and clean up the damage we've done. But unless you've got an environmental or regulatory objection with where we're operating, nothing's off limits. I'm sorry about that.
Garrett couldn't believe it, but with the sudden appearance of Vicky Kaiser, he actually didn't mind Holloway quite as much. At least he was just doing his job, whereas she was doing it out of spite, a vendetta that had gone on for generations. Garrett was just about to turn his ire back on Vicky when a sheriff's deputy's Tahoe pulled up. There was a glare on the windshield, but a shift by the driver revealed his best friend, Tony Sanchez, behind the wheel. Garrett looked to Vicky and shook his head.
That really necessary?
She eyed the two guards who were still on the ground nursing their injuries. They seemed to make an extra effort to look like victims. I'm sorry to do this, but Talon is going to have to file a temporary restraining order on you as well.
You know why I did this, Vicky.
You telling me you wouldn't have done the same if it was your father's grave? Garrett knew she'd always been a daddy's girl. If she cared about nothing else, maybe that would hit home. When she didn't answer, he tried his luck with Holloway.
What about you?
Holloway broke eye contact and looked off into the distance.
It's not up to her or me anymore. Went up the chain to Chicago. I'd do something if I could, but I'm just a
landman.
Garrett assumed Holloway was going to say messenger, but as long as all their cards were on the table, he wanted the guy to admit that Talon Corporation was no different from any other oil and gas company in the world.
That's right, Mr. Cole. I'm just the landman.
Garrett couldn't believe it, but he actually detected a little remorse. He never imagined he'd have preferred dealing with Holloway, but with a witch like Vicky Kaiser as the alternative, it made for an easy call. At least his role in this fiasco wasn't personal. With Vicky, on the other hand, everything was personal, particularly when it comes to family. Sanchez called out as he marched up from behind.
What's going on here, Garrett?
Garrett didn't turn. He kept his eyes locked onto Holloway.
Oh, we're just having a little meeting of the minds, that's all.
Sanchez surveyed the damage around the gravesite, then eyed the busted-up guards, who were still nursing their wounds. It wasn't hard to figure out what happened. Garrett knew his friend was in a tough position, and he didn't want to make it any harder for him. Sanchez had always been there for Garrett, as much of a brother to him as Bridger. When Tony's father died and Butch was drinking and distant, they'd had each other. Preferring the ranch to prom and hunting season to football season, Garrett and Tony had the ranch. It was an alternate universe where they lived in a perpetual state of Old West purgatory, somewhere between the time of cowboys and Indians and the modern world.
Yeah, Tony, it seems that Mr. Holloway and I have come to an understanding now. I was just about to leave.
Sanchez looked to Holloway.
Sounds like matters are resolved, then.
Holloway nodded.
There'll be some paperwork I'll need to sign.
Garrett knew that had to do with the TRO, keeping him off his own property. He'd have put up a fight, but not with Sanchez there. His friend had no choice in the matter, and given the condition of the Talon guards, he was lucky to be leaving without handcuffs. Turning to his mother's gravesite that was nearly destroyed, Garrett looked to the one responsible. The dozer driver who'd done the damage was standing slack-jawed at the top of the steps. All Garrett could do was shake his head. Ray Smitty was like a bad penny. No matter how far you chucked him, he always turned back up. 21. Of all the things that should have occupied Garrett's mind leaving the ranch, it was the guard's pistol that had him stymied. He was packing a GSH-18, a Russian-made 9mm that few Americans or Europeans used as their go-to sidearm. Every gunslinger has a preference, but most operators lived by the philosophy that you dance with the girl who brung you. Garrett, however, was the exception, opting for his Nighthawk over the Beretta M9A1 he carried in Army Special Forces, or the Glock 17 he used with the DEA. Still, the GSH-18 was an odd choice for anyone other than former Spetsnaz, Russia's Special Operations Forces. Those pistols weren't commercially available, making them nearly impossible to find. Garrett let out a sigh when he felt the buzz of the cell phone in his front pocket and saw on his dash that the call coming in was from Kim. Last thing he needed was another problem. So as not to worry her, he mustered up a greeting that was all sunshine and roses. To what do I owe the pleasure? There was a pause on the other end, which Garrett immediately took as a bad sign. He braced for impact as Kim launched right in.
Got a little news on our situation.
A little news. That wasn't what he wanted to hear. She'd have said good news if it was anything other than bad.
Okay, lay it on me, I guess.
On the positive side, she began, it looks like we have more time than we thought until Asadi has to go back.
More time is good, Garrett agreed. But what does that really mean for a permanent fix?
Means I've got more time to work on that. To try and convince the deputy NSC director who's pushing this thing that there has to be another option. Got a meeting with him next week to see what I can work out.
What's the bad news?
Bad news is I'm meeting some resistance here. Not a lot of support from my boss, which means he's getting pushback from upstairs.
Garrett knew that her boss was talking directly to the CIA director. There'd be no talking him into anything no matter how hard Kim tried. Getting an asset on board like Omar Zadran was a nice feather in his cap and a huge win for the agency, which meant the chance of keeping Asadi in Texas was as good as gone. Look, Kim, I know why they want this to happen and I don't blame them, but Asadi's just a kid. He's already lost one family. I can't let him lose another.
I know, Garrett, I know. Like I said, I'm working on it.
Garrett went silent. He was well aware of what the outcome would be. The CIA wasn't any different from the DEA in some regards. When leadership made a decision, there was no going back. Bureaucratic wheels turned slow, but once in motion, they were nearly impossible to stop. Kim filled the dead air.
You okay?
So as not to give away his plan to flee with Asadi, Garrett changed the subject. Yeah, I'm fine. Just have some big problems going on around here.
Asadi okay?
Kim sounded alarmed. No, he's great. Just something to do with the ranch.
Anything I can help with?
Remembering the Russian handgun and Ike's mysterious tale of trouble in Africa, Garrett launched a little salvo of misdirection to get her off his scent. Ever hear of an energy company called Talon Corporation? There was a pause on her end.
Doesn't ring a bell. Why?
They've got a heavy hand, that's all. Ike mentioned he'd crossed paths with them in Angola, and they weren't exactly the sort that plays nice in the sandbox, if you know what I mean.
Few in Africa do,
Kim chuckled.
They're drilling on the ranch now?
I wish. They're digging.
Digging? Kim sounded genuinely thrown off. Digging for what?
Rare earth minerals. There was an even longer pause on her end this time.
Talon, you said.
Garrett could tell she was no longer making friendly conversation. Kim's intel ears were perked for a reason, but he doubted she'd tell him why. Something jog your memory?
Had a few cables come across my queue on rare earth minerals lately, becoming somewhat of a security topic, given the fact that Beijing controls the bulk of the world's supply. The Chinese are even digging in Afghanistan now, using the Taliban as security. Can you believe that? Garrett knew he was grasping at straws, but had to ask. Maybe they could tie the company destroying his land to a terrorist organization. Do the Chinese have any connection to Talon Corporation? Not that I'm aware of, but let me check. Maybe I can find something that'll help. Relieved she'd taken the bait and forgotten about his plans to abscond with the boy, Garrett smiled as he pushed the gas and pulled back onto the road. He turned to his truck's open window and gazed out at the broad swath of Texas plains, as wide as the sky was tall. Garrett was just about to end the call when she added, "And listen to me, cowboy. I haven't forgotten what you said the other day." Damn it. He faked ignorance, but knew deep down she'd never buy it.
Said about what?
"I know you love Asadi, and I know you're in pain because I feel the same way, but don't do anything stupid. It won't end well." When he didn't answer, Kim pressed, "I'm giving fair warning, Garrett. You have to trust me." Garrett ultimately agreed with her and promised not to do anything rash, but the truth of the matter was that nothing was resolved. And when the call ended, he was still left with one big question. What the hell do I do now? 22. Central Intelligence Agency, McLean, Virginia. Kim hung up the phone, wondering what Garrett was up to. If he fled with Asadi, there'd be a swift response from the 7th floor, where the CIA director and high-level officials pushed buttons and pulled levers that ended lives. Special Activities Center operatives were relentless and at times merciless. Garrett was in a world of danger he couldn't fully understand. Opening her desk drawer, Kim reached in and took out her favorite photograph of Garrett and Asadi, the one where they're wearing their Stetsons. They were both on horseback, sunset on the horizon, and smiles as wide as the open plains. The Texas cowboy and Afghan villager, though born worlds apart, had come together as a family. They were even starting to look alike. Kim smiled, pushed back from her desk, and turned to the empty lobby of the Crime and Narcotics Center in the new headquarters building basement. Deputy director was as busy a job as it was solitary. Climbing the CIA's leadership ladder had left a wake of peers with bruised egos, and the ones who weren't jealous were often intimidated. A sip of cold coffee from her green Dartmouth mug, and she wondered how long she'd been sitting there, daydreaming. Kim stared at the maxim of her alma mater and read it sotto voce. Vox clamantis in deserto. All she could do was shake her head and laugh. Never had the phrase, "the voice of one crying in the wilderness," felt more apropos. Damn, it was lonely at the top. Raised in Hartford, Connecticut, Kim had attended boarding school at Choate, did her undergrad at Dartmouth, and master's work at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. She'd been top of her class from grade school, an achiever, a perfectionist, a career conqueror in every sense of the word. But the higher she rose, the less she seemed to gain. It was one of those classic Twilight Zone ironies she was still trying to process. Never one to wallow, Kim brushed off the self-sorrow just as CNC Director Bill Watson flew through the door into her office. Bill looked surprised to see her facing him. "You hear me coming?" Rather than raise an unnecessary red flag concerning Garrett and Asadi, Kim pitched the rare earth minerals question.
"Ever hear of Talon Corporation?"
If Bill was surprised before, he looked downright stunned. He pushed back a few dark strands of hair, which were always falling out of place.
"Been talking to the 7th floor, huh?"
Realizing she'd stumbled onto something important, Kim ignored the question and took the opening instead.
"Thoughts?"
Bill was one of the old school intellectual Ivy League officers that never took off his suit coat. But with him, there was usually something askew. Sometimes he had missed a button, or he'd forgotten to shave. Today his tie was loose and tossed over his shoulder. Bill wasn't necessarily a friend, rather somewhat of a confidant and professional ally. He'd hired her on as his deputy after serving as her second command in Afghanistan at Camp Savo. His promotion over her wasn't because he was better, but because he was better connected, a bureaucratic ladder climber who'd played the CIA's career advancement game ruthlessly well. Bill let out a defeated breath, moved to the chair against the wall, and slumped into it.
"My thoughts are that Talon has a few skeletons, and the administration wants somebody high up over here to give it the green light on U.S. operations. Looks like this company has been buying up energy assets all over the country. Bill shrugged. Easy to do when they're worth pennies on the dollar. They'll make a fortune when prices inevitably rise. Kim raised her eyebrows and nodded, as if those were her thoughts, too. Wanting to milk him further, she popped another question.
Why did the NSC director send it over here?
Just insurance. Bill shook off the notion. Politicians need someone to blame if this blows up in their faces. You know how it goes. There are policy wins and intelligence failures. Amazingly, it never seems to go the other way.
But you don't think there's a security angle to this, do you?
Bill looked at her curiously. What are you talking about?
Damn it. Wrong question. I mean, why bother us? If it's a trade or export controls issue, it'd have state or DOE written all over it. Or if there's a tax thing going on, then why not FBI?
It's all just a formality. The president and our director have been tight for years. My guess is they need us to run interference with the Senate. The press has been all over the fact that China is buying up ports around the world, including a few major ones here. Foreign investors were bound to raise some eyebrows from the hawks in Congress.
Maybe their concerns are valid.
Well, I've learned those eyebrows tend to sag after campaign contributions start rolling in, and there's a sudden interest in their charitable foundations and political action committees.
Kim took a moment to contemplate that disheartening reality before asking the question to which she already knew the answer. Really think that'll happen?
According to my sources, it's already happening.
Bill was a wheeler dealer on Capitol Hill, having influential contacts with big players on both sides of the aisle. She'd even heard his name bandied about for a White House position as National Security Advisor. Better him than her. Kim hated that world, and most of the people working in it. She had enough information to go on until she tapped into her own sources. Well, Bill, you know more about what's going on over there than I do, and I'd like to keep it that way. Since Bill didn't make the connection between Talon and what was happening down in Texas, Kim figured she better let it go, particularly since there were political sensitivities involved. I've got enough on my plate with the whole Garrett Cole situation.
Oh, yeah. Bill looked amused. How is the High Plains Drifter?
Not good, I'm afraid. She pursed her lips. I just gave him the bad news.
Bill lost his smile. You don't think he'll...
No, not Garrett. He's a rational loose cannon, you might say.
Bill again looked amused. Kind of an oxymoron, isn't it?
You just got to know the guy. He's different. Complex.
Complex? We're talking about the same guy, right? The one who galloped his horse across Texas on a killing spree?
Cartel sicarios, Bill.
Kim felt her face reddening.
Vicious murderers and kidnappers. If anyone ever deserved a bullet, it was them.
I'm just saying, subtlety isn't in Garrett Cole's wheelhouse. His tactics have caused a lot of problems for you. Bill narrowed his gaze. And more importantly, me.
Didn't see you complaining about his tactics when we brought in Emilio Garza.
No. Bill shook it off. We got our trophy in the end. Made a lot of people happy.
Then there you have it.
Kim smiled with the satisfaction of getting Bill to admit that bringing Garrett into the fold was a good idea.
Cole gets results, and he takes good care of Asadi, which leaves me one less thing to worry about.
Bill paused, as if in deep thought. Well, that issue is about to be resolved. Kim sighed involuntarily and immediately regretted it. Like her, Bill was trained to detect nonverbal cues, and her reaction was a huge red flag. What's the problem, Manning? You knew from the beginning there was a possibility that Asadi would return home for good.
I know that, but things have changed. And Pakistan isn't really his home.
Close enough, Bill shot back. And he has family there. That's all that matters.
He doesn't even know those people. And aside from that, Asadi has a family here now with the Coles. It'll kill him if we take him away.
You don't know that.
I do know that.
Again, her response was more forceful than intended.
Sending him to live with Omar Zadran is a bad idea.
Bad idea for who?
Bill studied her the way CIA operations officers evaluate an asset under too much stress, the kind who get cut loose from the job. He leaned forward and stared her down.
You know what's riding on this. This deal with Zadran keeps us in the game. The NSC wants this, which means the president wants it. So, end of discussion. The kid goes back.
Not if I can convince Connor Murray otherwise.
The words slipped out so fast, she hadn't even realized she was contradicting a direct order from the CIA director.
Connor Murray?
Bill's eyes went wide.
Deputy Director of the NSC, Connor Murray? What makes you think you can change his mind?
Before she could answer, he focused in on the photo of Garrett and Asadi in their cowboy hats, lying on her desk.
Bill, I think if I can talk to him, I can...
Forget it.
His eyes went from disappointed to accusatory.
I think you're too close to this thing, and it's clouding your judgment.
What are you talking about?
The heat in Kim's cheeks was now fueled by his perception. Last thing operations officers wanted was to reveal any weakness. At the CIA, even among friends, you didn't want to give up any leverage, particularly if it was based on emotion.
Because I care about the situation doesn't mean I'm getting too close. I'm doing my job.
Your job is to carry out the order.